This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For the better part of a year, Philip Gerard has been contributing articles on the little-known history of the Civil War to Our State magazine. A creative writer, these are nonfiction pieces that help modern readers experience that period in our history through the stories of ordinary people of the time. Families left at home, slaves, freed African Americans, and soldiers. Now Philip Gerard has turned his attention to the true stories of more contemporary people as he lets us experience the world and world events through their eyes, mostly his eyes. His award-winning book of essays is called The Patron Saint of Dreams, and we're going to talk about that book, those stories, the intersection of creative writing with nonfiction and more, because Philip Gerard joins us for the hour. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, my great pleasure to be here.
As I mentioned, I think the last time you were here, we talked about the Civil War stories that you've been writing for Our State magazine for the better part of a year. Is that continuing?
It'll continue for the duration of the sesquicentennial, so I'll feel like I fought the whole war by the end of it.
So how many you're doing one a month, so how many stories are you into this so far?
I think we're 15 or 16 in now.
Really? So the sesquicentennial, if I've done the math right, is only a year. So.
Well, no, they're celebrating for the whole 4 years.
Oh,
that
okay.
Would correspond
right.
With the 4 years of the Civil War from secession until the surrender.
So you're not even halfway through yet. My goodness.
It's daunting.
So you've been writing this monthly series not about the battles, but the ordinary lives of those folks affected by the war, including soldiers, but usually in non-combat situations. How challenging has it been to find interesting stories, because you shared some of the stories with us last time that you'd written up to that point, and they were highly detailed stories about people that most of us have never heard of. So what kind of a challenge has this posed for you?
Well, it's very challenging, but it's also a lot of fun, and it's kind of like detective work. You find one thing in a diary and it mentions something else, and a historian says, oh, by the way, have you looked at this? And somebody will come to a reading or call me at the office saying, hey, my great-grandfather left me this letter. And, you know, it really, one thing begets another, and it's a great bit of piecing together those clues to find what I need to write about.
And what made these interesting and fun to read were the fact that this is not just some dry retelling of the facts of a person's life or circumstance. You're a creative writer, and this is, although it's nonfiction, you are, how can I say this, not embellishing, but you're making it interesting. So talk about the intersection of creative writing and nonfiction. How do the two come together, and how do you know where the line is?
Well, I think the line is pretty clear, that I try to make sure that if I know the facts, I stick to them, and if I don't know the facts, I make it clear that there's something provisional that we're speculating or trying to create a plausible scenario. But the way that I'm trying to make it interesting is to use the tools of a fiction writer. That is, a good story usually is someone is in motion toward fulfilling a desire, or they're trying to escape something they fear, and there's usually something trying to stop them. There are hurdles to overcome. There's an outcome that matters to them, to other people. And in the case of the Civil War pieces in particular, trying to capture that in their perspective when they didn't know how it was going to turn out. So there's a great deal of suspense in their lives. I mean, they're not sitting there saying, oh, we're in the middle of history. You know, history is happening locally. It's first of all their own lives, and trying to put myself in their position, I think, is the way to get that.
Does the through line that you just talked about, this thing that actors look for in a script, this desire to get from point A to point B and from point B to point C, is that something that becomes clear as you learn more about these people, or is this something that you hope will happen as you do the research on these
people? You hope that there'll be a through line, and there's always sort of the fallback through line, which was that everybody was trying to figure out a way through to the other side. If you were at home, your husband was away at war, you had the farm, you were trying to survive. If you're a soldier and you've got a battle, you're trying to win the battle and then get home safely and like that. So, but there are individual through lines as well. There are friendships and love affairs and, you know, various other kinds of things that people are hoping and wishing and working and praying for.
But how do you do this without putting, we can't know everything about everybody. How do you, there's a story, there's an essay in your book about how you've gotten something, you've told this story or you've written a story and you've done the best job you possibly can to get the facts right. I think you were a journalist, functioning as a journalist at one point in your life, and you were sent out to cover a car fire.
Oh, my very first story.
Yeah, and the editor screams across the newsroom, go cover this car fire, there's a hero in this, go get it. And you
yeah,
do.
He says, go,
And you come back with this story, and years later you discover that it's completely false. It's completely wrong. So when you're approaching these songs, whether it's for this, these stories, whether it's for this book or whether it's for the Civil War series, how do you put thoughts in people's heads, words in people's mouths that you didn't hear because it's, you know, 150 years ago, and maintain the truth of it?
Well, in that case, it was the preconception that I started with. Get me a hero story, my editor said. So I went there looking for the story of the hero, which was the high school kid that pulled his girlfriend safely out of a burning car. And I wrote all about that. I had the license tag. I described the sky. I interviewed the fireman who put out the fire. But it turned out that I didn't ask the one question that mattered, which is how come the car's on fire? And it turned out the kid had set the fire and then had second thoughts and rescued his girlfriend. So I guess the answer of the lesson of that is don't go into it with a preconception. You've got to let the thing kind of well up in you and start to teach you what it's about before you can, you know. And sometimes you're very lucky. When I was writing about Julius Leinbach, who was a Moravian musician from Salem, he was very clear about the fact he did not want to fight in the war and the conscription agents were coming. And so he hit upon the idea of him and his church band basically enlisting as musicians, knowing they then would be non-combatants. And so he goes to war as a musician, and we know that because he wrote about it, you know, quite plainly. So sometimes you get lucky, and other times you've got to kind of parse it and say, what was going on between the lines? What's the kind of the fact behind the other facts that I need to figure out to get the context of this thing right?
In the introduction to your book, The Patron Saint of Dreams, John Jeremiah Sullivan, who wrote that intro, calls these essays the work of an observer. Is that not what all good writers need to be? He obviously singles you out because you must be exceptional at this.
Well, he was very gracious, and he is a wonderful writer in his own right. I love his work, and he knows what good reporting is. And I think I actually learned most of what I know about writing in my anthropology courses in college, which was a matter of deep observation without judgment. You know, they would show us things and say, tell us what you see. And we would all start out by making a judgment. And then the professor would say, no, look at it again. What are you seeing? And then we'd have to break down what we were actually looking at before we attempted to overlay some kind of a value on it. And I think that's the key for any reporter. And I think every good writer starts by being a great, you know, trained observer. And it's something you can learn. You can teach yourself to do it. I send my students out into the world all the time and I say, go watch, for example, somebody doing an interesting job and describe it in such a way that I could do that job and also that I understand what that job means to the person doing it. And it's a very easy assignment. It's a very hard one to write, but it teaches you something essential about the craft.
Well, I was going to ask you if this power of observation and taking what you've observed and putting into writing is something that comes naturally for you or whether it's something that you really do have to work at, or maybe you had to work at it at the beginning and now it comes more naturally. Talk about that.
Well, I've always been curious about almost everything. I mean, my wife kids me. I'm interested in, you know, there's practically nothing I can think of that I'm not interested in. I'm the kind of guy that wants to look in the window and see what's happening. What I loved about being a newspaper reporter was I was the guy that got to go across the police line, behind the scenes, backstage, and kind of poke my nose into all the places where you don't get to go normally. I think, though, that you can cultivate that and get better at it and train yourself to do it right. And one way to do that is, you know, I don't go anywhere without a pen and a notebook these days. I often carry a camera. I make drawings, anything that will help me kind of remember and put a physical shape to the thing that I want to describe later on the page. And anything that occurs to me as I'm watching it, because it may not just be a description of the thing. It may be what the thing made me think of at the moment I'm watching it. And I can make those connections.
Of course, when you're out on an assignment as a newspaper reporter, you're being paid to observe and to ask questions and to get to the bottom of things. When you're going through your own personal life, and many of the essays in this book are things that happened to you in the course of your life and your observations about them, are you consciously aware of observing everything around you at every moment of every day?
I think it's a habit. I think it's a habit in the way that, you know, I'm a guitar player, so I can't walk into a room without kind of saying, what would it sound like to play and sing in this room? I think if you're an architect, you walk into a building and you can't help but notice the structure of it and the way the acoustics are good or bad or the way the roof line is elegant or not so elegant. It's sort of a habit of who you are after a while. And so I don't think you're consciously saying, well, I better notice this, I better notice that, so much as you just kind of absorb it. You're kind of on duty all the time.
Well, now, we're not sitting in the same studio. You are in, I guess, near Wilmington.
I'm in Wilmington. Yeah, downtown. Yeah.
And so I have no idea what your surroundings look like. Close your eyes and tell me what it's like.
Well, it's a little room. It's a studio, as you might imagine, with a big control panel in front of me with all kinds of blinking lights. And there's a window into another studio. There's an engineer standing by. There are various kinds of acoustic panels on the wall. But we're in the middle of a very nice old building on a nice old street that has lots of historic structures, and a lot of the architecture that's interesting is above the first story. So it's the kind of city where if you walk around, you want to look up a lot. And we're in a nice old building that has been turned into a radio studio.
So when you write about this conversation in your next collection, 20 years from now, will you remember all that detail, or is that something that will be lost, or will you file that away somehow? I mean, because you never know, I suppose, what might end up in a story.
Right, right.
Or in an essay in this situation. So what do you do with all this detail? Where does it go?
Well,
how do you keep track of it all?
There are things you do enough. I've been in this radio station probably 500 times now, so I've got a pretty good mental, you know, I could navigate it in my sleep. But I've also, since I was a teenager, kept diaries, journals, and notes of one kind or another. So even as I was backpacking around the country, you know, after high school, I was writing down notes and conversations and what have you. And I had no idea that I'd ever, you know, be a professional writer, but they intrigued me enough that I wanted to capture them on the page. And so I'm lucky enough to have a lot of that to go back to when I decided to write about something that happened, you know, 25 or 30 years ago.
So you've got stacks of notebooks?
Oh, yeah.
How do you keep track
of all
what,
sizes?
How do you keep track of what's in the? I mean, how do you catalog what's in the notebooks? How do you know what's in them?
I use the kind of Moleskine black notebooks that come in a variety of sizes, and I write on the back of them every time I've got a subject. If it's, for example, the Eversboro battlefield, I'll write it in Sharpie on the back, silver Sharpie, and then on the spines I date them, so that when they're on the shelf, if I want to go back to, you know, 1998, there's the one from there, and if I want to find something on my visit to, you know, Charlotte Talks, there it'll be.
So will you take notes on this?
I may or may not. Sometimes
okay.
I'll find myself taking notes a little bit after the fact.
And do you find yourself going back to these volumes of notebooks on a regular basis to do what you do? Or are they just there for safekeeping in case someday you might need to go back to them?
No, I think of writing as a kind of active process. I don't really believe in the blank page because I feel like I've already got a whole bunch of pages filled up. And what I'll do if I've got, you know, if I'm casting around for a writing project, I'll just simply put a bunch of those notebooks out on my desk and start leafing through them. And I'll often find out that I've come back to the same thing in various forms over several visits or years in different books, and I'll start just kind of copying down in my computer things out of the notebook so that I have them all in one place. And sometimes the passages will begin to kind of talk to one another. And when that happens, I think, something may be happening here. And then other times it's more deliberate. If I know I'm doing a piece for the magazine about a particular person or battle or place, what I can do is simply go to that place knowing that I'm going to write down everything I can possibly think of, see, experience, whatever, and then come back and again put that all into my computer notes so that I can draw from it.
Philip Gerard is a writer. His latest book is called The Patron Saint of Dreams. It's a collection of essays, and it's the winner of the 2012 Gold Ippy Award for the essay by the Independent Publishers Magazine. We're going to continue our conversation and talk about these essays in this book when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Isiola Lodge at Linville Golf Club, featuring local fresh cuisine, a Donald Ross Championship golf course, fly fishing, and spa, located off the Blue Ridge Parkway. Information, isiola.com. And by Hendrick Acura, introducing the all-new 2013 Acura RDX Sport Utility, 273 horsepower V6 engine and 28 miles per gallon. More details available at hendrickacura.com. Well, Sunday marks the 40th anniversary of a very important date in American history. June 17th, 1972 was the date of the Watergate break-in, the third-rate burglary that would bring down a president and shake the country to its very foundation. Several North Carolinians were involved in investigating and prosecuting that burglary, among them Rufus Edmiston, and Charlotte and David Erdman, and both will share their memories of those heady days tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Vatican accuses a group of American Roman Catholic nuns of being radical feminists. There are efforts to bring attention to the needs of the poor and the role of women in the church.
Join that conversation on the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Philip Gerard is our guest. He's the chair of the Department of Creative Writing at UNC Wilmington. He's writing a series of articles about the Civil War and the sesquicentennial for the next 4 years for Our State magazine, one a month. And his newest book is called The Patron Saint of Dreams. It is a collection of essays. Now, you've been writing for how many years?
Oh, I can't remember when I wasn't writing.
Okay.
I was a kind of compulsive writer in high school and college, although it never occurred to me it'd be something you would do for a living.
You understand why you became a compulsive writer? What was it in you that you were exercising?
I think it was a combination of two things. One was that I grew up in a household where there were magazines and books everywhere, World Book Encyclopedia, Reader's Digest, Time Magazine, what have you, and all kinds of, every birthday brought a new biography of George Washington or Daniel Boone or something. And I went to Catholic school, and they were very, very, very good at teaching writing. So I remember learning to write, when I was 6 years old and finding that it was an amazing thing to be able to put a pencil or pen to paper and create, symbols that meant something that other people then could read.
You talked about growing up in a house full of magazines and books, and kids today don't. Because the people aren't taking magazines and they're not buying books. They may have a Kindle stashed away someplace. I don't know. So because you teach young people, have you noticed a change over the last several years?
I have noticed that they're much more amenable to online and things on their various devices, handheld devices. But I also noticed that when you put a really good book in their hands, they find it to be quite a gift. And I think that the experience of reading is different. I have more and more students who are no longer using their computer to write. They want to get a fountain pen and a nice ream of good paper or, a notebook and a pencil and go out. They're kind of disengaging a little bit. And I think it's good for their art. There's something tactile about using a pen, even if you're making notes with it.
I'm curious about that because if it's more tactical, more tactile to use a pen and paper as opposed to just typing onto a keyboard and a screen, is there something about reading on paper versus reading on a screen that is different or more productive or better, or can you say it's better or worse?
I think it's better. For one thing, my eyes.
Paper is better?
Paper is better, yeah, I think. One thing is that it's much easier on your eyes, I think. Another is that it's really portable. I don't mind taking a book into the bathtub or down to the beach, and I hate to take a device. But also, I find myself, if I'm reading on the page, that I'm reading more slowly, that I'm flipping back and rereading, to get context for something new. The whole experience has a different quality of deep immersion as opposed to feeling like I'm just taking in information. Maybe people disagree and have a different experience, and it might be my generation. But
you've been reading for years, and I believe this is your first book of essays, correct?
Right.
Why essays? Why now?
Well, I've been writing essays for a long time. In fact, many of the pieces in here at least started, 20, 25 years ago, 15 years ago. And I just sort of never got around to collecting them together. And after a certain point, I realized, I want to do that now. And I had written about writing nonfiction. I'd written full-length nonfiction narrative books and published a lot of essays over the years separately. But I thought I wanted to put them together and make them more than the sum of their parts, so that something, and that's what a book is, I think. It's not just slapping things between covers, but the cumulative effect of it all should be something a little bigger, a little larger, a little more meaningful than just reading them all separately.
And when you read through these stories, if you did not know they were true, they could easily be fiction. So how does this differ, this form that you're using in this book with the stories that you're telling? How does it differ from short stories? Just the simple fact that it's not fiction?
Yeah, I think one of the things that defines the art of writing nonfiction is you're stuck with what happened. I mean, it's a glorious thing in one way because you have a ready-made plot to the extent that you have facts that go in that direction. The problem is that if it doesn't end the way you want, or you don't know the ending, or there's some crucial piece of information that you don't have, you can't make it up. So there's a piece in here, a story about living in college in a converted house. And we had this mysterious visitor to our basement that we could never catch. Well, in a short story, I'd be able to write a really crackerjack ending and say, wow, here's who it was, and here's why, and it would all be wrapped up. But in life, we never did find out the answer to the mystery. And I would say most of the essays in the book, they're really like true stories more than essays. They're narratives that have at their core something that is mysterious, something that can't quite be found out altogether. And I think that's what actually makes the form, working around what you don't know.
Is that why you have said that this book, this collection of essays, addresses a mystery of sorts? Is that what you mean by that?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
You've been a writer for most of your adult life. You've also been a university professor at several schools around the country. But your resume is peppered with things, odd jobs, like bartender, busboy, dishwasher, roofer, musician, house painter, bouncer, supermarket clerk, and so on.
Sure, I worked as a long-haul trucker in graduate school.
Were all these jobs just to make ends meet, to see a different point of, or to see a different point of view in life than you would have seen if you'd stayed at universities or sat in front of your computer?
Well, yeah, I mean, most of those were early in my career when I was simply trying to, you know, put food on the table, pay the rent and what have you, so... You know, I did a lot of, you know, what we call, I guess, physical labor, menial jobs. I was in the Meat Cutters Union for a while. I was a special education aide to work my way through college. I played in bands. I washed dishes. But all those things turn out in retrospect to have been great things for any writer to do because, of course, you're getting into the different professions. You're seeing different kinds of people. You know, on the long haul job, you know, we went all across the country from Beverly Hills and Las Vegas to down to Florida, you know, cities, towns, down on the Cherokee Reservation in Oklahoma. So you really got the grand tour in a way that I never would have just done on my own.
And all these observations, were they collected by you in some forms even back then?
Oh, sure, yeah. God, I remember I even wrote about the moving truck job. We had picked up a load in Florida for a woman in Beverly Hills, and it was in Las Vegas we were taking her to, I believe, and the everything, it had been a pallet in a warehouse. When we got it there, it was just completely smashed. And as we unloaded one broken item after another, this woman just collapsed on her sofa in tears. And then as we spent several hours filling out the insurance forms, and finally she stopped crying and offered us some refreshments, and she said, you know, I apologize, it's not right to cry over things. And then she gave me a copy of a book to read on our way to California. And the book was Sophie's Choice.
Oh.
Well, you can't really make that up. And the things that were broken, she had probably the only truly valuable things we carried the entire summer. I mean, she had, you know, really good furniture and artwork and one thing or another. And it was all, you couldn't have destroyed it more thoroughly if you'd taken a mallet to it.
What happened?
So it had been dropped probably in the warehouse. Somebody lifted on a forklift and probably dropped the whole thing and then repacked it and didn't tell us, you know.
Great.
Was sort of typical.
Claudia from Hickory called and couldn't hold, but she wants to know, because you have done all these odd jobs, all of which pay money, so many schools offer degrees in creative writing. What can you do with a degree like that? Not everybody's going to write a Harry Potter bestseller series, so what do you do with that?
Well, I always look at it as preparation for any kind of job in which you need to communicate. We have students that go into publishing. We have students that go into public relations. Some of them, and most of them keep on writing, especially the graduate students, keep on writing one way or the other and publish. And they're doing a variety of things till they do that. But especially at the graduate level, it's really an apprenticeship. It's a way of saying, okay, this is something I want to do, and I'm going to take these 3 years and do it. And then I'll never have to say, I wish I had done it. And whatever training we can supply, and whatever experience they have, which is the important thing. It's not really the degree so much as the experience that takes their writing from one level to another. That's going to be their shot. But I think in terms of undergraduate, any good liberal arts education that teaches you to write, to think, to observe, that's what you're going to need to do, because you don't really know now what the professions will be in 10 years, 20 years, or 30. And the likelihood is you'll have several. You're no longer going to be the, you know, join the company at 18 and retire at 70 with a full pension. That just doesn't, that's not the model anymore.
Well, you're a good example of that, because you started out as a journalist, a newspaper reporter, and you never took a journalism class. You took English. Correct? Of course, you need to be able to write, I suppose, to be a journalist, but there are rules of journalism that you didn't get because you didn't go to those classes, right?
Right, right. And I kind of wish I had, but on the other hand, I think my anthropology classes served me in good stead. They were very much into the social anthropology model of participant observation, where you immerse yourself. And I remember my thesis as an undergraduate was an immersion project on my residence hall that described the games people played in the hall, the social gathering, the taboos, the mating rituals, you know.
Is it a difficult sell, because you're on the academic side of things, is it a difficult sell, this liberal arts education today, because now people are so focused on how much money it costs to go to college, and they want a return on investment. They want to know that their $40,000 a year or whatever it is going to result in a six-figure-a-year salary forevermore. And if you're an English major or a creative writing major, there's no guarantee, as there might be if you went and majored in medicine.
Well, sure, I think that goes for pretty much any of the things like history, English, creative writing, anthropology. You just don't know where they're going to lead. But there are an awful lot of successful people who are at the top of organizations who are liberal arts majors. And so I think the payoff may be a lifetime payoff rather than I walk out the door and get my, you know, $100,000 a year job at the firm of X and Y. So it's the difference between training and education in a way. Education is meant to prepare you for your life with all the complexity of that.
So are the kids in your class all from different majors, or are they pretty much English majors, or I'm not sure there's a creative writing major, but...
Yeah, there is creative writing, and we have, at the freshman level, they're from all over the place. And actually, that's great, because it's lovely to have, say, a biology major or someone interested in business or whatever, and they're also writing. And that kind of leavens the class. When you get further into the major classes where people are deliberately wanting to be writers, they're doing that. But we also have them take other courses in other departments in order to round themselves out.
So. You have said that you were influenced by reading Jack London as a young person, by reading Mark Twain, Robert Louis Stevenson, Charles Dickens, Ernest Hemingway, and you've been taught or mentored by some other great writers. And now you teach creative writing at the college level at UNC Wilmington. Is this something that can be taught? Can a kid walk into a classroom with a good teacher and really learn this, or do you have to have some innate talent and an ability to observe and recognize what's important and put that on paper and make it interesting?
Well, I think you have to be willing to open yourself to it and discover what your level of talent is. And what we're very good at, for example, in my program, is taking that person who is maybe very shy, doesn't think they've got the confidence to be a writer, and maybe they're a first-generation college student, or maybe they never thought they'd go to graduate school, but, you know, then they got the bug and they want to do it. And they probably are not the kind of person who's just going to go and live in an apartment in New York and write their great novel. They probably do need guidance. They probably do need somebody who's both coaxing them and challenging them to a different level. It's sort of like mining ore. You don't know what's in there until you start digging it out. And then there's a certain humility at the process, but there's also a little bit of an audacity that you have to have. I always kid about it, but I say, okay, here's my quiz in the first day of class. How many of you were the kid who, the week before classes started when you were in fifth grade, loved going to Woolworths and picking out pencil cases and pens and notebooks? And all the ones that shoot their hands up, I say, okay, that's great, because that's the first thing. How many of you loved to read and that was how you spent your rainy days? And they put their hands up and I say, okay, we've got two good things going for you. So the rest of it, I can teach you the craft part, and I can sort of nudge you and encourage you and cajole you and coax you and challenge you to go deep into yourself and pull out the stories. And there are some, you know, tricks we can use to do that. And you see amazing progress often, even in the course of a few weeks with that kind of a student.
We're talking to Philip Girard, whose new book is a collection of essays, most of them about personal experiences, not all. It's called The Patron Saint of Dreams. He'll be in town on Sunday to sign the book at 2 o'clock at Park Road Books in the Park Road Shopping Center. What were you taught by others to get you where you are today?
Oh, what was I taught by? That's a great question. I think I was taught that I'm not special in a way that if I'm not going to rely on my native genius, that hard work is a good ethic to have. So, you know, that was always drilled into me both by the nuns, by my parents, and by, you know, professors who would say, you know, you did this, but you got lazy. Take it to the next level. Do the next thing. Do the last thing to make this right. So that's one thing. Another thing is that I've learned from writers and writing friends, writing teachers, that there are many ways to tell a good story or to tell a story well, and there's no formula. And as soon as you tell a student, well, you shouldn't do this, then they turn in a story and they did that, and you know what? It was brilliant. And so you really have to be kind of open about it all. And the other thing, I guess, is that if you're going to get by in this business, you really have to take criticism. And you have to realize it isn't personal. Your allegiance is to trying to make the thing as true and as good as it can be, not to your own ego. You're not writing it to be celebrated and to have written. You're writing because somewhere somebody's going to pick up that piece of writing. You're never going to meet them, probably. And if you've done your job, they're going to have a really great experience and come away with something valuable. And that's my job, to make sure that's in the piece.
You were talking about how you would tell a student occasionally, don't do that, and then they go away and they do it in the next story that they write, and it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And that sounds a little bit like jazz. I mean, you have to know, as a really good jazz musician, you have to know the rules of music. You have to know theory. You have to know chord structure, etc., in order to go away and break those rules and make it make sense. Is that essentially what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. And, you know, Flannery O'Connor had a great way of saying it. She said, you know, you can get away with anything you can get away with, but no writer's ever gotten away with very much. So, there's a confidence that a reader has that they're in really sure hands. And if they feel that, and they feel like, okay, this person knows what they're doing. Like being in a car, you know, on a snowy road with a driver, you know, okay, this driver knows how to drive in snow. Mm-hmm. You're communicating that to your reader, and then the reader is willing to go out on a limb with you sometimes. Say, mm-hmm. Whoa, okay, that's a little different, but I'm staying with you because I trust you.
You've said that your aesthetic has developed partly as a result of feedback from students and watching students take risks in their work that you couldn't or wouldn't or didn't take. When you see that in action, do you then use that as a signpost to take similar risks?
Well, it does keep you honest. And what I tell my students, you know, I just got done teaching a year-long course in the book length, both fiction and nonfiction. And I started out by saying, you know, you're here to fail. You're here to try everything that doesn't work in order to find what will work. And that's great. So don't sit down thinking, oh, my God, I have to write a perfect, you know, draft the first time out of the box. So my students are constantly challenging me about what I think is true about writing. And so if I say, okay, I believe X about writing, and they go, really? And then they'll argue with me, and they'll show me something, and I'll say, you know what? You've convinced me I should try something new, or maybe there's a different way to do this, or maybe this is great for me but not for you. And so there's a kind of, you know, writing is a thing that I've never gotten to the bottom of. As long as I've done it, as long as I've taught it, you know, there's always something new, and I wake up and I think, why didn't I know that before? Hmm. You know, it seems so obvious now, but why didn't I know that before?
When we come back, I want to share some of the little portions of some of the essays that are in this book of essays, The Patron Saint of Dreams. Our guest is Philip Gerard. He's the chair of the Department of Creative Writing at UNC Wilmington. But this book is something special. So we're going to come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Talley. For more than 75 years, representing developers and lenders in acquiring, financing, developing, and selling real estate. Horak Talley, attorneys who get things done. And Winston-Salem State University, offering a traditional campus setting and progressive programs to prepare a diverse student body for success in the 21st century. www.wssu.edu. The Vatican accuses a group of four of American Roman Catholic nuns, rather, of being radical feminists. Their efforts to bring attention to the needs of the poor and the role of women in the church, the topic at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, and online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
On the next Radiolab, what's going on inside our guts?
25 feet of coiled, soiled, fetid tubing.
Corned beef.
Meat and bread and coffee.
Salt. Pastrami sandwich.
Mini burgers.
It's steamy.
I don't know, it's like bubbly.
Kind of disgusting.
But fascinating.
Thousands of species that are living inside of you and preying on each other.
The mysteries of the human gut, this week on Radiolab.
That's Friday night at 8 at 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The Patron Saint of Dreams is the collection of essays we're talking about today with Philip Gerard, who is its author. You have an essay in the book called Hardball. It's baseball season, so we might as well talk about this first, in which the narrator is a baseball player on a team in a small Vermont town. Is that
right?
You? That's you,
that
isn't
it? That is me. That is me, and this is an example of an essay that began a long time before I knew how it was going to end.
It's a story about baseball, but it's also a story about hopes and dreams and their intersection with the downside of reality, about character and how it's formed. When you sat down to write that story, was all of that already there, or did it come to you in the writing?
No, it came to me in the writing. I mean, when I had the season, this was playing, you know, hardscrabble team in Vermont. They played hardball. They told me it's hardball, son. You know, it's not baseball. And they slid high and they filed their spikes and they threw hard and they were desperate guys. But so I wrote about that even at the time. I mean, I took notes on it and I wrote it down because I was fascinated by the season we had. We got to the playoffs, you know, and I turned it into, originally it was a radio piece, a very short piece. And then it was years later when I realized, you know, this wasn't about baseball. This was really about how do you navigate that space between being the boy with all the hopes and dreams pinned on you. Because these guys had all been, you know, the star college and high school athletes or whatever. And the next thing that comes when disappointment happens and life doesn't work out quite the way you imagined, and now you have to figure out, you know, what the secret of your character really is and move on. And that came many years after the original piece.
So these guys, this team that you were playing on, were these guys professionals in some minor league, or were these just pickup games or community games that were composed of guys who had great promise and talent in their high school and college years?
They were not minor leagues or even semi-pro, but they were organized leagues, and they played different towns. And it was sort of an old model that I think was very big in the 19th century. Mm. And so teams would bus in from, you know, 20 miles over or 30 miles over, and we'd play games or doubleheaders. And then we had pretty much our starting nine, and that was about it, you know, not a lot of substitutes.
Will you read a portion of that for us?
Sure. After college, when I lived in Burlington, Vermont, and tended bar at the Last Chance Saloon, I got recruited to join a baseball team in one of the small outlying towns. We played other town teams, usually on weekends. Our home field was built on the edge of a granite quarry. Beyond the outfield fence lay oblivion. At the first practice, as I trotted out to my position in left field, the center fielder warned me, "Don't go diving over that fence after a ball. It's a long way down." I leaned over the chain-link fence and stared down about 100 vertical feet onto solid rock, flat and smooth where the gray stone had been carved away in great square slabs. "No prob," I said. The infield was dangerous and fast, hard-pan base paths and close-cropped grass. Pitcher's mound was high, and the batter's box was a ditch. It was as if whoever designed this baseball diamond had tried to make it as hard on everybody as possible. So that was the field we played on.
Yeah, and you talked about how this, at the edge of the field, it was a granite quarry. At the edge of the field, there was this gigantic drop-off into oblivion.
Right.
And you end the story that way. You say, "I imagine them out there still, roaming ugly, hard-scrapple fields in a far-flung country places, throwing low and sliding high, inflicting as much pain on each other and themselves as they possibly can, season after season, waiting to take the last great flying leap over the fence and into oblivion." Why?
Yeah.
Well, these are very driven guys. You write about that throughout this story. They're driven because I guess they're trying to prove to themselves that it wasn't them, it was the breaks that they didn't get maybe that led them not to be professional baseball players. But why oblivion?
Well, I think oblivion is about forgetfulness and about losing the responsibility of being conscious of who you are and what you have to do. I mean, it's the same reason we love sleep and dreams. It's the same reason we love going to a movie in the middle of an afternoon when we're feeling bad, because it removes us of the responsibility of having to deal with life. Mm. And that's sort of the way I felt with some of those guys. Yeah. I mean, and they were great guys, don't get me wrong, but they had never quite hit reset after their big dream hadn't worked out.
And yet you, as a writer, that's what you deal with. You deal with life and trying to come to terms with it. And these are essays that mostly about your life, not all of them, but most of them are. Why is it easier for you than it is for these guys who play baseball and can't come to terms?
I think my great, in that particular case, my great advantage was that I was never very good. I mean, and I've seen this phenomenon over the years where you've got people who are really good at something very early. It's much harder for them to let go. If you're, you know, I always played baseball for fun. I loved the game. I was never that great at it. I could hit a long ball once in a while, you know, and the whole thing. But I never thought, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to play for the New York Yankees. Mm. Although I dreamed one time that I played a whole game with them, but that's a different story. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't my dream. And I think when it's not your dream, you can walk away from it. For me, it was one more recreation option that I loved. But, and I think that's true of almost anything, whether, you know, I've known musicians who've never quite made it and can't get past the disappointment that they never quite got the record deal. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you know, I was a musician, but I thought, you know, I'm just not good enough. I'm smart enough to know that I don't want to wake up when I'm 60 years old and realize I didn't do anything in my life because, you know, I couldn't let go of something. So I play music for fun.
Since you observe these guys who have trouble coming to terms with the reality of their lives, is there, and you've written about them, is there a theme that has emerged that might help them to come to terms with what has happened?
I think it goes back to what I tell my students that if, you know, and baseball is a great example, that you're here to fail in a way, because failure is what teaches you what comes next. If you're, you know, my wife always kids me, she goes, that guy only hits the ball 3 times out of 10. How come you think he's a good hitter? He fails 7 times out of 10, and yet he's in the Hall of Fame. And I think that's not a bad way of looking at it, that you're going to get knocked on the head, you're going to, you know, run into brick walls, things aren't going to work out, and what you have to then do is say, well, okay, I got rejected by 10 magazines, I'm going to send my story out to an 11th. You know, nobody likes my book, I'm going to write another one. You've got to figure out, you know, and believe me, every writer knows about rejection, so it's actually a kind of a good teacher if you can just, if you figure out what the lesson is, and the lesson is do the next thing, move on.
Hmm. Let me take a call from Gary, who's been holding on for a while in Albemarle. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'd like to make a comment. My experiences as an engineer, and most of our writing was obviously nonfiction, but it was very important to be able to express ideas and concepts to the reader. And I think a good writer takes into account the reader, whether it's describing a baseball field, as was just done, or the attitudes of the players, or whether you're describing a concept that people haven't been introduced to before.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a wonderful comment, and I'm thinking a number of our students and faculty are very good at writing about science and writing about things like engineering and biology and the environment in ways that allow you to understand what somebody actually means by, you know, something happening in fluid dynamics or something happening in evolution or what have you. And I think that's a wonderful comment. And I do believe, yeah, there's a reader on the other end. Nothing that you write is alive until it comes alive in the reader's imagination.
Hmm. Gary, thank you for your call. Appreciate
it. You're welcome.
Neil couldn't hold, but he says the book sounds interesting. Is it appropriate for high school high school aged audiences thinking about recommending it to a sophomore? I would think it is okay, don't you?
It is. There's a little bit of profanity in there, but it's not gratuitous. It has to do with two stories in particular in which, you know, certain words are actually an important part of the story.
The bear story?
The bear story is one of them, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Why the title, Patron Saint of Dreams?
The patron saint of dreams, I talked about this with my editor at some length in coming up with titles. There are lots of dreams in the book, for one thing. There are the dreams of, you know, dreams of glory, dreams as ambition, but there are also real, actual dreams that you have when you're asleep and interesting things happen. And I, having been raised a Catholic, I always sort of had thought I was guarded by a guardian angel. And as I went on the road as a kid, you know, every college summer going out on the road, hitchhiking around, I always had the feeling of being watched over, and I realized that I was always hearing my mother's voice in the back of my mind. She'd say, like, that's a stupid thing, don't do it, you know. And so I'd be like, don't get in that car, you know, don't sleep there, why don't you go up the road and do this instead? And I kind of had internalized her very good sense about things. And so I kind of think of her as the patron saint of dreams, and the book is dedicated to her, and there's the title piece is about her. So
yeah. And there's, yeah, the title piece is an essay about your mother, who you say is the invisible character in just about everything you have ever written. How so?
Well, you know, she started to read my first novel, Hatteras Light, and I kept calling her saying, did you read it? She finally said, you know, I couldn't get through it. I said, oh, Mom, you couldn't get through it. And she said, it was just too personal. I felt like I was reading your diary. I said, Mom, it's about, you know, these lifeboat guys and lifesavers on the Outer Banks in 1918. We don't live on the Outer Banks. It's not 1918. She goes, no, but you're revealing so much of yourself. And she just had that ability to kind of see through me. So, you know, I'm kind of losing my thread here, but
okay. I just ask you why she's the invisible person in every story.
But she, I think your parents always stay with you, and my mother in particular. You know, we became great friends when I was in college. After you go through a period when you're a kid and your parents are just your parents, when we could just simply sit and talk about things, and I would come and bike home from my apartment and have lunch with her, and we would talk. And we just got to know each other in really, really good ways. So, she is not explicitly in a lot of pieces, but her presence, her ethic, you know, her stoicism, her ability to suffer without complaint, her wisdom, you know, whatever I know about the world, a lot of it probably came from her. So that's what informs the book.
You write that you've tried to write about her before her death and couldn't, and instead you say writing about her death made you able to write about her life. Why do you think that is?
Well, when you write about something, you're reliving it. And so if you've been through a trauma, sometimes one of the worst things you can do is write about it right away. Sometimes it's a good thing, and it's therapeutic. In the case of my mother, she took many years to in failing health, first with Parkinson's and then finally winding up in a coma for a number of months. And it was such a prolonged, agonizing process to watch her fail, to watch her no longer be able to write letters, to watch her no longer be able to speak, and yet be fully, completely alert and aware with a sharp memory, sharp intelligence and wit, but be closed down. And it was so hard that every time I would start to write about it, I would simply dissolve, and I would say, no, I can't even think about that for the moment. And it was only sometime afterward, and in fact in a dream, when she appeared to me in the dream as a young, vibrant person, the mother I remembered from my childhood, and pretty much gave me implicit permission then after that. And the lesson was, stop thinking about people, anybody, whether it's my best friend who died or her or anybody, in their death. Think about them in their life. Think about what they added to the world.
But you did write extensively about her death, and this essay, or a portion of it, a shortened portion of it, appeared on, I think, All Things Considered on NPR, and got a considerable amount of response from listeners, because you go into great detail about the agony of watching someone that you love die or be in a semi-vegetative state, and you go into a situation where your father made the mistake of putting your mom on a ventilator, and then once you do that, you can't take them off without, you know, moving heaven and earth.
Right.
And a nurse coming to you and telling you, essentially, no one's going to be here for about 5 hours, and you can unplug the ventilator, and she will pass on, and no one will know. And you couldn't do it. And then you write about the guilt that you felt in writing about it and making her most personal, private moment so public.
Yeah, and all those things are true and important. She was a private person of that generation. You know, they never spoke about money. They never spoke about bad things that happened in their family before they had their kids, you know, whether it was something that the grandfather had done or whatever. Mm-hmm. All that was intensely private. And so for me to take that and put it out into the world felt like it was something I had to think about before I did it.
Yeah.
But again, I felt having, oddly enough in that dream, I felt a permission from her saying, no, this is a story you can tell. It's okay.
Talk about the essay we've already mentioned, Bear Country. This is actually two stories about fear and danger and near-death experiences that you wove together. In one story, you're a 19-year-old at Yellowstone camping in Bear Country against the warnings of a park ranger. In the other, you're a 43-year-old who has a blocked artery that nearly kills you.
Right. It begins when I was 19 and knew I'd live forever. I hiked alone for 4 days in grizzly bear country. This is an adventure story about invisible bears, fear, a crossing, and the day I died. And this was another case where I had a lot of stuff in my journal from that trip. And I was an idiot, you know. I went to the park and I thought, I need to hike in the backcountry. I was on my way to Wyoming and ultimately California. And the ranger's saying, you're an idiot. Don't go out there, you know. And she couldn't stop me. There was nothing illegal about what I was doing. But I was a kid from, you know, the suburbs of Delaware. I'd never been in the wild before. And everywhere along my hike for the 3 days I was out there, I was seeing bear scat. I was glimpsing them, you know. I was seeing their tracks and the campfire of my own camp. And yet that wasn't what turned out to be dangerous about the trip. It turned out to be something else. And many years later, after I had gone through that, you know, near-death experience, where I had been dead. My heart, at least, had stopped for a period. And trying to, again, figure out what to do with that, I realized that, you know, that was about fearing the wrong thing as well. And the two of them together become a kind of a braided essay of the two narratives interweaving and then coming together.
Which I think clarifies something else you've said about writing. It's always been for you a kind of deep meditation, clarifying the truth of difficult situations. And that's a good example of that, I think. We have to stop. It's been a great conversation. It's a terrific book, and I think it is appropriate for high school students, despite that one little story in there that might have a word or two. Philip Gerard, the patron saint of dreams and the winner of the 2012 Gold Ippy Award for the essay. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you, Mike.